Welcome to the freshest episode of the Wednesday Conversation you have ever heard. My name is Bob Thune. I'm here with Dusty White and Chris Hemmelman at, what time is it, Dusty?
5:45 a.m.
5:45 a.m. on Wednesday morning, November 6th. It's the morning after the election, and we wanted you to have an absolutely fresh episode for today. So we decided we'd get up early and do this right now. So
did you guys even go to bed?
Yes,
I did.
Absolutely.
Okay. I did.
Good.
You stayed
good
up all night, Chris?
No, I slept a little bit.
I did have a kid get up in the middle of the night, though, and I was like, hey, this is not the night for that.
So welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. On this podcast, we talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. One of the things we've all been paying a lot of attention to over the course of 2024 is both the presidential election, but also lots of local factors and initiatives. And so we wanted to give you a real fresh update and response to what happened last night. So here are the big storylines. Number one, Donald J. Trump is your next president. He's the Grover Cleveland part two, the only president to serve a term and then go away and come back for a second non-consecutive term. Chris, man, that's like a deep cut from history.
Yeah, yeah.
In your local races, in Nebraska anyway, Deb Fischer and Pete Ricketts both won their Senate races. Hey, what happened? I actually didn't even pay attention to the Don Bacon and Tony Vargas. Have they called that race yet? Sorry, I should have that right in front of me.
No, I didn't.
Right, I'm finding out right now.
When I was going to bed, Bacon was not winning. I know that.
Hey, nobody wants to know. This is a lot. This is fresh. Nobody wants to know what happened when you went to bed. Nebraska Secretary of State. So I'm going to find that out, guys. What was the most surprising thing to you last night?
Do we even have an answer?
Yeah, you were expecting delay.
Bob was looking at me like, what does that mean? Yeah, I did not expect that when we came in this morning to record that the election would have been called. So I'm proud of America. We got our stuff together to be able to actually count the votes in a timely manner, at least for the most part. So I was glad to be proven wrong.
I apologize, listeners, for failing you. I now have the Nebraska Secretary of State website in front of me. Don Bacon wins by about 10,000 votes. So that's actually a pretty significant.
Yeah, that's close.
I thought that race was going to be closer than that. So Don Bacon wins. And by the way, shout out to Pastor Justin Curtis of Corndale Church.
Yeah.
Wins himself a seat on the Millard School Board. That was a big win. And the local shout out to the people, not just of Corndale, but a lot of people throughout our state who fought hard to work against the ballot initiatives that would have made abortion a lot more available. And in fact, not just a lot more available, but legal throughout all 9 months. And so that was initiative 439, which was very barely defeated, but did get defeated in Nebraska by about 30,000 votes. And then initiative 434, which is a constitutional amendment to restrict abortion. And that one passed by an even higher margin. So that's good news for pro-life laws in our state. Chris, your main surprise was you didn't think it'd be over by now.
Yeah, I guess I just didn't know if the infrastructure was going to get any better.
Yeah, and it seems like there were some states that fixed their infrastructure and some that did not.
Yeah.
Like there was a lot, I noticed that people were mentioning on Twitter, Florida had their votes counted in like, 2 hours after the election closed. And then we're still waiting on Arizona.
We're still waiting on Michigan.
What's up with you West Coast people out there? Let's get these.
It is pretty amazing if you think about it, that we can get that done that fast.
It is. It's true. There is an aspect of it that efficiency is pretty impressive.
Let's talk about what you thought would happen. So I asked these guys we have a Slack channel, internal Slack channel. And I said, hey, what do you think is going to happen? Hellman said, you thought Trump would win, but you thought it wouldn't be called by the time we record. So you were kind of expecting it might take a few days, or what did you think would happen?
Yeah, I figured Trump was going to win for various reasons. But like I said, because of the slowness, it was going to be kind of this, hey, it looks like he's trending to win, but not official. And then also, my skepticism of the media and their reluctance to want to actually call it. So that's what I thought, it was going to be. All the signs were there that he, at this point, that he was going to win, but it wasn't necessarily official and finally called.
By the way, in case you're wondering, the Associated Press called the presidential race at 5:37 a.m. this morning. Or at least that's the article I'm reading, that maybe they have called it multiple times throughout the night. But the headline I'm reading is 5:37 a.m. The AP has declared that that the race is over. So that's a big deal. Dusty, your prediction was, you said you think Trump wins, but because people don't want Kamala. It's kind of what it goes down to.
Yeah, I think I just think Trump wins. Obviously, he does now, but I was thinking Trump wins, not landslide wins. But I think people in America are ready for a female president. I think you probably had a lot of female voters show out, but not for Kamala, because I think it's like more of the same.
My prediction was, I guess I used the word landslide. I said, hey, I think Trump's going to win in a landslide. I think it's going to be pretty decisive. What I meant by landslide was simply that we would know before the night was over. I thought, yeah, this mm-hmm. thing's going to end on election night. There were a few reasons I thought that. One was I paid a lot of attention to some unusual pundits outside the political mainstream who actually were sort of economists who were paying attention to how the markets were it's the same thing people do with interest rates where they're like, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates or the Fed's going to lower rates. There's people who can look at what the markets are doing and sort of say, here's what it looks like the trend is. And those people were saying the markets are trending in the direction of the markets are betting on a Trump win. And so I thought that was a pretty important factor. It was also pretty evident to me from the polls. I want everybody to remember this 4 years from now. You know, before the election, all you have is polling data. And polling data notoriously underrepresents conservative people for a very simple reason. Because if someone calls your house and says, Chris, we want to talk to you about how you're going to vote, conservatives are less likely to say, I'm going to vote for, you know, Donald Trump, or I'm mm-hmm. going to vote for a conservative candidate, than more liberal people are to say, I'm voting for, you know, whoever the candidate is. And so polling just tends to overrepresent progressive people and underrepresent conservatives. And so when you saw all the polls were sort of a dead heat, I just assumed, well, that's good news for Trump. I mean, if the polling data shows a dead heat, it's going to always underrepresent a conservative sort of silent majority that's out there. And I think that's kind of what you saw across the country. I'm looking at the New York Times election map in front of me here on the screen. It's showing Donald J. Trump with 277 electoral votes right now. The states still uncalled are Arizona, Nevada, and Michigan, and Maine, I guess, for those of you way up in Maine. But the important states that Trump has flipped, according to this map, are Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and North Carolina, which were key battleground states that it looks like he sort of really soundly did good work in those states. And so according to right now, looks like he's easily got the electoral votes, obviously, to be the next president. The other big news, of course, is the Senate race, which right now, 52 Republican seats. There's a lot of races that are still close and haven't been called yet, but 52-42 is what the U.S. Senate shows right now, which means the Republicans have flipped three seats. That's particularly big news for me and my family, because there's a high possibility that my uncle will be elected as the next Senate Majority Leader. That's an internal election, so it's a silent ballot.
Oh, wow.
No one really knows. And that could go either way. There could be lots of things that happen there. There will obviously be some jockeying within the Republican Senate, but that's an interesting shift that will have effects for me and my family. The U.S. House right now is too close to call in terms of which party is going to control it. So it looks like it's 197 to 177 in favor of Republicans right now. But I think the House and Senate races will be the ones that will leak in over today and possibly over the next few days as some of those very close races get counted.
So your prediction as far as the landslide, however you wanted to find it, in some ways is proving to be true, because it looks like Trump has headed for the popular vote win as well, which would be the first time since Reagan that a Republican has done that.
You're asking that like I would know the answer to the question.
I figured you would just kind of know off the top of your head.
No, I didn't do all the election research for this podcast that I should have done, because I was focused on some other things.
Yeah. So I think that is the case, that this will be the first time a Republican has won the popular vote since Reagan.
Well, and the interesting thing about that is, actually, it would be really good news for America if the same person won the Electoral College and the popular vote, because it just helps there not to be like, oh, you know, it feels like for the last six elections, it's been like, well, that person didn't win the popular vote. And so you get all this sort of, you know, people arguing that, you know, we should get rid of the Electoral College or whatever. So it's actually, I think it's just good for sort of clarity when those things happen together. But yeah, that's a big deal. And of course, what you've heard throughout the sort of evening and morning is that Trump has outperformed expectations in some strange categories, specifically among Latino voters, among minority voters, among working class voters. So there's a ton of places where there's going to be interesting postmortems done, I think, by the Democratic Party to say, where did we miss here? And I'm sure, you know, a lot of that is probably speculation right now. Maybe there'll be some data that sort of reveals that well. But what do you attribute the shift to, Chris, in terms of Trump's overperforming expectations here?
I am not a political expert, so this is take this for what it's worth. But I think, to your point, Dusty, I think people are just significantly unhappy with what the country is. I mean, and based on any metric, really, it feels like there's not a lot going well for us, kind of in the larger trends as a country now. Also, you know, we're also compared to a lot of places in the world, we're doing okay, but there is just this malaise that has kind of been over our country the past 4 years. Coming out of COVID. So when there is such a distrust or dissatisfaction with government, people want change. And so your options are more of the same, and you have Trump. And Trump is just such a unique candidate in so many ways. But I think that probably is a big part of it, is that it just, I was watching one political pundit say, you know, it was like 70% dissatisfaction. And when it's that high, there's just, I mean, you're just facing a really big challenge if you're Kamala to overcome. And then you have this very charismatic personality who's promising change, who kind of has the moxie to kind of rile up the crowd in some ways. And so I think that's probably a lot of what happened.
Dusty?
I think most of it comes down to common sense, in the sense of Trump's able to like talk just in common sense language to people. And you've had Biden, who can't really talk much at all.
Yeah.
And so I don't even know if it's policy and politics as much as it just comes down to like, oh, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about, even though he talks crazy a little bit, belittles people left and right. But he does some things that are just pretty smart. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he went on the Joe Rogan podcast. We talked about that a little bit. That's a two hour and like 15 minute or something podcast where Rogan just gets him talking. But then Rogan does this thing where he brings him back to whatever question he's doing, you know? And I'm thinking about like, man, if Trump were in this studio, you're going to just let him do whatever he wants, you know, yeah. I think, but then you're going to, so gonna Rogan does
direct
a,
him.
Rogan does a good, I think that's a wise move on the Trump campaign, you know, like that's a wide audience. So stuff like that just gets the common sense voter out there to be like, you know, just if these are my options, I want some more common sense.
And he resonates with the working class voter, which is, it's incredible. I mean, he has essentially flipped a whole demographic to the Republican Party, at least in voting, that used to be the stronghold of the Democrats. And the guy is a New York City real estate broker. I mean, he's the least blue collar guy out there, and yet yeah. he can relate to that. I mean, he is a fascinating political, I mean, I personally, you know, I don't love the dude, but he is a fascinating character in so many ways. I mean, the guy's almost 80 years old, but you would never know that the energy he has, the way he carries himself, nothing sticks to him. And I think that's the other thing is everyone's scratching their head. You would think that the scandals, the problems, everything that they have tried to stick him with. I mean, he's in court. They're trying to like actually lock him up for various things. And yet nothing. And here he comes back stronger than ever. Now he's got the popular vote. If any guy you think wouldn't get it, and here it is. So there, I think there are things just about this election that are, that just buck trends and are just unique in some ways. And again, I think it probably goes back to common sense stuff. It goes to, you know, just people are feeling the pain of a number of things in our country. And so they'll take that over what we have.
Well, what's fascinating is if you've traveled anywhere in the world, it is interesting to think about how people globally relate to Trump. because people are fascinated with him. Whether they love him or hate him, he is a larger than life figure. I remember being in Germany a few years ago, and I was sitting at this pub, and I do not speak German, and the guy sitting next to me did not speak English. And he and the thing he said to me was, he looked at me, he was, Trump! You know, he wanted to talk about,
yeah.
And this was back in, I think, 2016, so it's been a few years ago. But my point is that there is sort of like an odd, I don't know, charisma, and he's a polarizing figure in America, but he's also just somebody that the world is kind of interested in because they're like, what's the story with this guy?
Yeah.
Let's review the sort of timeline, because this has been one of the weirdest years of modern political history.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. It was January 15th of 2024 that the Iowa caucuses happened. That was 10 months ago now. March 5th was Super Tuesday, when Trump sort of, in the Republican Party, sort of seemed to take a bunch of the momentum. The next day, Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. She was the final competitor to Trump. And so basically by March 6th, it looked like, all right, looks like Trump's going to be our candidate. For better or for worse, whether you love it or hate it, that seems to be where things are going.
And he did it without even participating in the primaries at all.
Yeah.
Again, it's just so unique. Yeah, I don't have to come.
So then June 27th, that was 18 weeks ago, Chris. That was the first Biden-Trump debate. That was the thing that sort of set the whole world spinning, when it was very evident, holy cow, Joe Biden is not in good shape. And so that was less than 5 months ago that happened. And that created a pretty strong response. I mean, you saw polling data start to shift heavily toward Trump, and you saw a lot of media figures start to say, hey, Biden, I'm not sure he should be the candidate.
Yeah. A lot of Democrats saying that.
Right. Then July 13th, you had the Trump assassination attempt. Okay, so, I mean, which was crazy.
Yeah.
You know.
It was crazy, and nobody really talks too much about it.
The largest Secret Service failure in our lifetime, and a presidential candidate almost getting assassinated on live TV in front of the world. That was crazy. Then, like, 2 days later, the Republican convention begins, and then July 21st is the date that Biden withdrew from the race. August 5th, Kamala Harris is confirmed as the Democratic nominee. That's 90 days ago. So Kamala Harris has been the nominee for 90 days. I think that actually is part of the story here, because what nobody is really talking about, you know, the news today is all Biden, Kamala, but not a whole lot of people are talking about the woman had 90 days to try to run for president.
Yeah.
And I don't think she was a stellar candidate to begin with.
No.
But she certainly was starting from a pretty significant deficit because things looked real bleak. If you were a Democrat voter and Biden was your guy, you know, in July, everybody's like, well, this race is over. I mean, you know, you had people saying basically like the election's over. And so it was clear that Biden's hand got forced just by the nature of reality. But, Kamala Harris has only been the candidate for the last 90 days. And I think, I mean, I try to pay attention to, I listen to, like, what are my kids saying? What are their friends saying? Because I'm just trying to, like, you know, people who aren't like, they're not interested in, like, political commentary. They're just sort of like reading the vibes, you know. And it was evident to me that everybody looking at Kamala was like, this person is word salad. Like, she does not say much at all. And contrast that with you had Trump going on Rogan. You had Trump kind of doing like weird podcast circuit, you know, alt media stuff that I think the Rogan show actually is going to be sort of one of the stories of this year, because he also tried to get Kamala on the podcast and she wouldn't go on. And then she was like, hey, Joe Rogan, I'll do an interview with you in Virginia. You got to come to me. And he was like, that's not how this works. So you had Trump sort of playing to what you might call new media, you know, and you had Kamala basically just trying to like not do public appearance, almost as though she was trying to sort of like only be in environments where she could answer in a very sort of scripted way. And that was part of the knock against her, was just like, you can't get her unscripted. You can't get her to just like have a conversation about, hey, so tell me what would you do about this or that? You know, everything was sort of talking points and very tight. And I think, so for whatever, I think she was at a disadvantage because of the length of time she was in the race. But also, I just think people did not find her to be a compelling candidate. Now, I'm not sure anyone finds Trump a compelling candidate, but obviously they find him something, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's compelling or whether it's just intriguing.
Well, when she was chosen, I remember saying this to Mindy, like it's either they're being very cynical and realize they can't win, or they have such confidence that Trump is not a viable candidate a second time because of all the problems that they could basically run whoever. Cause she did not make sense as a candidate. Cause when she ran in the primaries, I mean, she got smoked. I mean, she wasn't even no momentum, no right. interest. So at the national level, you put somebody in a position that has really no genuine enthusiasm behind. I mean, people got behind her because it was like, if we don't get behind her, then Trump's going to be president. So there was almost this kind of put on enthusiasm that people kind of, oh, this is who we have to get excited about.
This is our person.
Yeah, but it was never authentic. It was never genuine. It was never coming from a place of that she's a compelling story or she's a compelling candidate. And so that too, I think, played into this. I mean, and if you think, you know, what if the candidate wasn't Trump? What if it was, you know, DeSantis or somebody else? It's interesting how it potentially could have played out. Because on the one hand, you could say, someone with less baggage, this election would have been over, you know, much sooner. But also, Trump is just such a charismatic figure that it makes you wonder, yeah, he's got the baggage. But if a candidate with less baggage but less charisma could have done the same thing. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to speculate. But I to your point, Bob,
okay,
she just was not a strong candidate.
Let's talk about another interesting political calculation here that I think factors into. I'm interested to hear you guys' thoughts on it. So Harris had the opportunity to pick as her running mate the governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, who is Jewish and who is the governor, very popular governor of a swing state that she had to win this election. Instead, she picks Tim Walz. She loses Pennsylvania. I think people are going to game tape that and say, why would you not just go with the governor of the one state that everybody said you had to win the election? On the other hand, you have Trump choosing J.D. Vance, very young, very articulate, yeah. Yale-educated, smart guy. And I talked to people who were like, hey, I'm voting. I don't like Trump, but I do like J.D. Vance. And so I'm voting for Trump basically because I like what J.D. Vance represents mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. the possible future of maybe where this movement is
yeah.
going.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you guys think about how the vice presidential picks sort of shaped up.
Yeah, I didn't pay too close attention to the reasoning. So I don't know what was her, what seemed to be the reasoning.
I do not know.
Yeah. Cause that to me, it seems like, cause Minnesota is pretty much in the bag
right.
for the most part.
Yeah. Minnesota's always like blue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't understand that decision.
That was a short commentary, Chris. Yeah. Thank you.
I'll go for it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but usually the VP does not really help you get the seat. Is that right?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think you're going for someone who strengthens whatever. If you're trying to strengthen your base, you'd pick one candidate. If you're trying to reach out to a certain population, you might pick another.
Strengthen it, but usually don't mess it up, right?
Right.
It is interesting to me, and I think America's always going to be intrigued with a guy who says, like, I don't like Trump, Trump's bad, and then he'll just own it, you know? Like, yeah. the honesty of, like, yeah, I said these things about Trump, and I was wrong, and then he did this in his presidency, and so I actually do like him and I respect him and hey, let's just talk honestly. Like America has not done that in a long time.
Yeah, that's a good
so
point.
I think, you know, your farmers, you said working middle class, Chris, I think those kinds of people are like, yeah, I like this guy. This is my guy. I do think it's crazy that J.D. Vance writes a book and is all of a sudden the VP, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he goes from writing Hillbilly Elegy, which I read when it came out, and then he has this quick little run, and then now he's the VP. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, one of the youngest vice presidents in history. And I'm hopeful that, I mean, who knows where this will go? This is what's funny is like we're sitting here talking about this, and like the future could still be just crazy as heck. Who knows what's happening next? But I hope that what that means is that there will be some policy wonkiness in a second Trump administration that might help actually get some stuff done. Because I think what you saw in the first Trump administration was he won the election, but he could not govern and didn't have people around him and knew how to govern. And I hope that will be a little different this time around. All right, let's shift our attention now to some of the more local issues and especially to the ballot initiatives. Looks like we gained, from a Christian perspective, we got the outcome we wanted on abortion. looks like we didn't get the outcome we were hoping for on medical marijuana here in Nebraska. I was hopeful that we would defeat both the initiatives that advanced abortion access in our state and that we would defeat medical marijuana. But those votes went two separate ways. So we got a good outcome on abortion, less of a good outcome on medical marijuana. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll say this. My thoughts on, you know, initiative 434, 439, the percentage of for and against are just so tight that it's still pretty heartbreaking, you know? And I remember last night before I went to bed, just like we're sitting in the living room and we're watching everything on, you know, election stuff, all the election anxiety on your TV. And then when that hit, it was the initiative towards 434 was still behind.
Yeah.
And I was like, I said to my wife, man, I'm more concerned about that than anything.
Yeah.
And my gut just sank. So I'm grateful.
Let me read the data just so we can have hard data. On initiative measure 434, Nebraska Secretary of State website, all precincts and counties reporting, votes for this initiative, 496,586. Votes against, 401,072. So, Dusty, there's almost a 95,000 vote spread there for 434, which was to enshrine in the state constitution an amendment that says abortion is illegal after 12 weeks. So that's a win. 439 was the measure that was trying to do the opposite, to enshrine in the state constitution an unfettered right to abortion at any time for any reason. That one ended up against 462,000 to 436,000. So that one was defeated by only about 30,000 votes out of 900,000 cast. So that one was definitely a lot closer. And to your point, it shows that our state's still pretty divided, but I think it's interesting because I was involved with a lot of the people who were advocating for this and who helped to write the language of the 434 measure. And their concern was these measures have been going the wrong direction in like six different states over the past year. There had been six states that tried to pass greater abortion restrictions and that had been defeated. It looks like last night the momentum shifted because I know Florida's abortion deal was defeated as well as Nebraska's. And so I think though it is split and close, it seems like this is maybe a good trend for the pro-life movement.
Yeah, it's so interesting since Roe v. Wade was overturned to see this play out at the state level. And you see the cultural aspect of this. And in a place like Nebraska that is like deep red when it comes to at least presidential elections. And I mean, once in a while we've gotten Democratic senators, but it's a battleground issue in statehood. You just see that the cultural dynamic playing out here and it is encouraging, but I also, have you guys had conversations with like those in the pro-life movement that are considered like abolitionists where this isn't strong enough?
Yeah.
Had a conversation with a guy in our church who, when I, you know, made a comment last Sunday about voting for 434. He's like, I'm with you on voting against 439. He's like, but I don't know about 434. I don't feel like strong enough. And I said, you know, I understand. And I made that comment when I made it. It's like, it's not perfect legislation, but it allows us to build better policy. It sort of puts the stop so we can build better policy. So there's a pragmatic nature to it. Cause I don't love the language. I don't think it's a perfect bill. I don't love all the language. But it is the kind of movement that you want to see that allows you to build better policy.
Well, to that point, Chris, I think there's an interesting learning for political strategy there because I have some good friends who are like sort of hardcore abolitionists. In other words, and I had text messages a month ago from people saying, hey, don't tell your people to vote for 434. And their point was, because 434 enshrines a right to abortion until 12 weeks. So they're saying, yeah, it's a pro-life bill, but what you're saying is in the first 12 weeks, we're not going to do anything. It's only after 12 weeks that we're going to restrict it. And their point was, why would we not just say it's illegal at all times? And so their mindset here is it's similar to slavery, right? If we're dealing with a true moral evil, you don't want to be the guy that in history was like, yeah, we said slavery was kind of okay. You know, they're sure. Like, you want to outlaw it. It's an evil. So I appreciate the philosophy thinking behind absolutely. That. Yep. But my pushback was hey, in a state where, as Dusty said, the vote is split almost exactly in half, it seems like a wise pragmatic strategy is to take whatever gains we can get, put them in the bank, and then continue to do the work in terms of swaying public opinion, because it is very clear in Nebraska that an abolitionist amendment isn't going to go anywhere, because they had that working forward in the at the petition level, and it didn't go forward this year. And so there is the political will to get something done, and I was of the opinion it's good to get something done and take our gains one step at a time, because that's just how politics works.
So to your point about medical marijuana, you know, 10 years ago, I might have been in favor.
Really?
I think my libertarian streak was stronger.
Yeah. And there's there's people who would say that.
Yeah. And I still even do have a wrestle if you compare, you know, kind of using marijuana versus some other pharmaceuticals, you know, the cost benefit there. And so there is a part of me that, you know, is can understand the argument. But at the same time, I think over time I've just come to see that it's a gateway to legalizing marijuana fully in a state. And I think that is not a good thing for a society. And so I think that's where I was like, yeah, I'm glad to vote against this, but obviously in Nebraska, we want to be able to do this. So.
Well, this is another one of those, I should have research data in front of me that I don't have, but the question that's on my mind is, has there been any state that has legalized it medically that it hasn't led to full legalization? Because this does seem like it's just sort of the Trojan horse for let's legalize it everywhere. And that I'm going to hate living in Nebraska if that's the case, because every state that I know of that has legalized marijuana, you just have a proliferation of all kinds of chaos, you know, weed shops and it doesn't do good things for the social fabric and life of the state.
Yeah.
So I'm discouraged by that. But yeah, apparently I think the lobby there knows that the medical tag is how you get it. That's how you get the most people to say, oh, it sounds fine. You know,
Let them have it. That's what people think when they're voting.
Right. What are your reflections even more locally on just sort of, you know, things going on in the life of the city? So I guess, you know, many of our listeners are outside, you know, all over the world. There's listeners listening to this from various places. But for those who are sort of like Omaha, Nebraska or Bellevue, Nebraska centric, what's the big takeaway for Christians specifically coming out of this election?
Well, Sarpy County has always been a strongly conservative county in many ways. And so nothing's particularly surprising in the ways things kind of played out in Sarpy County. But I think for Christians and, you know, speaking to our context and county, these things don't just stay that way automatically, or, you know, there are drifts and in many ways, you know, there are still battles to be won in our state related to abortion as an example. And we still need better policy and move forward in policy. So there's still a lot of work to be done and to always be working for a more just and equitable society in the right ways, and not take for granted that because we live in a more conservative county, that the laws will always trend conservative, that the culture will trend conservative. So I think in many ways it's like, okay, be encouraged by the wins, be encouraged by what's the work that is in front of us and the resources and the open doors and the green lights that we have. So I think for Christians, it's just to say, hey, continue being salt, be light, be engaged politically, and really don't just sort of like go, okay, our job's done, we voted and we're good. Voting is such a small part of the big picture. So I want to encourage, you know, Christians just to continue to stay engaged.
I want to shout out a couple things. One is I'm very proud of the way our church got involved, especially on the abortion stuff. I feel like our church did a faithful job there. And then I want to shout out to two church members we had who ran for offices.
Yeah.
One didn't win his race, but it's fun to see two people from our church step in the ring, see their names on the ballot, see people who are trying to get involved at a local level and actually be a part of solutions and change and serving the city in these ways. And I know for both those guys, you know, it's like your name is on a yard sign in somebody's yard. Like you're kind of putting yourself out there in ways that are sort of, you know, the whole, I was teasing those people of like the whole city is basically just about to render a verdict on how they feel about your name, you know, like, how's that feel? Yeah. So it is sort of like exposing in a way, cause you're putting yourself out there and saying, well, you either like me as a candidate or you don't. So I want to commend some of the Christians who have taken the step to just do that. And I hope there will be more in years to come, especially in those very local ways, you know, school boards and public utilities commissions and city council, the very sort of local areas of leadership. I hope more and more Christians will say, yep, I'll step into that.
It is a really noble task. It's a lot of work. You undergo some unforeseen circumstances and some consequences that you just had no anticipation that were going to happen. And you put in the work and the grit and you're trying to make the community better. It's a really beautiful thing. I remember being in high school when I became a Christian, and there was a guy running for the Omaha Public School School Board. And I thought, oh man, I locked that memory in as like, man, you can do this. Like this is, you can try to make the city better. This is a really beautiful thing.
I'm trying to get a guy in our church to run for mayor of Bellevue.
That'll work.
I think he'd be great. He serves on a commission for the state that's appointed by the governor, something to do with like energy policy. So he's actively involved in politics. But I'm like, man, you got to run for mayor. You got to run this joint. So,
I love it.
Yeah. Trying to encourage more of our folks to get involved in ways like that. So that's cool that you know, two folks at Coram Deo.
Yeah. So go do that. Christians, let's get involved. And as we look back at one election and look ahead to, hey, what opportunities exist in the future for Christians to take a lead in some of these local elections, let's continue to do that. So, hey, before we close the podcast, let's try to get a live phone call with Justin Curtis.
Let's get him on the line.
One of the pastors at Coram Deo who won a school board seat last night. See if we can get him on the line and get a live 6:20 something in the morning. So
yeah,
this is going to be a toss up.
He's usually running a 5K right about now.
Here we go.
Hello, this is Justin. I cannot get to my phone right now. If you leave your name, your number, and a message, I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Well, hey, we tried. I'm sorry, listeners. You're not going to get a live late update night from Pastor Justin Curtis. Late but night. Yeah, he was up late. And congrats to him on being one of those local winners. All right, you're going to hear much more, I'm sure, in days and weeks to come. But we thank you for listening in and letting us just do. This is the freshest, livest Wednesday conversation we've ever recorded. We have never before recorded a podcast at 5:30 in the morning now to be released 30 minutes from now. So thanks, listeners, for being part of this. And may we continue to live as faithful Christians, whatever the political landscape looks like going forward. And hope you have a great day and a great week. We'll see you again next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.